That's the Trombones Inc., featuring some of the best trombonists of the 1950s, with J.J. Johnson's Doo's Blues, recorded in 1958, released the following year. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. Well, Education Secretary Arne Duncan announced last week that he will be leaving his post. Not too many people crying about that. He'll be leaving at the end of the year. But according to our guest, he will be leaving a highly questionable legacy, and it is likely, unfortunately, to continue with his replacement after he leaves. I introduce you to Dr. Thomas C. Pedroni, Associate Professor of Curriculum Studies and Policy Sociology at Wayne State University. He also is the co-director of the Detroit Data and Democracy Project, and he has been, for us, a great help in understanding things educational. Thanks so much, Thomas, for being with us today.
Thank you so much for having me on, Eutrice.
So what's going on with this announcement that Arne Duncan will be no more after the end of the year? You're saying he will still be there in the person of his replacement. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, we were hoping that in the run-up to the final year of Obama's presidency that we were beginning to see the signs of some significant shifts around his urban policy, and especially in regard to issues that deeply affect urban communities of color, especially impoverished urban communities of color. After all, we've seen Obama make unprecedented steps in the direction of recognizing the appalling devastation that has occurred for urban communities of color, as so many African American men and women have been jailed as the result of policies that really were enshrined under a previous Democratic president. Bill W. Clinton, as part of the rollback of the welfare state and the rollout of the neoliberal state, with bills that were tough on crime, with three strikes, you're out. And the fact of the matter is that generations of African-American families have lost significant participation of important members of their family to incarceration, incarceration that is largely spurred by deeply racialized criminal justice system, by deeply racialized policing of urban neighborhoods, by disproportionate sentences for crimes that African Americans are more likely to be caught for than any other racial or ethnic group. So we were hoping that we'd see something similar in the education front, that we saw this sort of thawing regarding sort of the penal state. And we thought now, maybe in his final year, Obama would hear the outcry of so many teachers, so many communities, so many leaders within the worst put upon communities, where we've seen this terrible dismantling of our public schools, the smashing of neighborhoods as schools have been closed, as key pillars of those neighborhoods. And so there was this initial rush of excitement when we heard that, oh, my God, finally, you know, Obama has heard us and Arne Duncan is on his way out and we're getting someone else now. And but we soon heard within an hour or two that his replacement would be New York Schools Commissioner John King, who is at least as invested in the failed policies that Arne Duncan represents as Arne Duncan himself did. So if we kind of look at Arne Duncan's legacy and look to its continuity, Arne Duncan is someone who, on the one hand, endlessly emphasized the importance of evidence-based practices and rigor in education, and instead brought us one type of educational reform or another, whether it was high-stakes accountability or race to the top, or whether it was his four visions for transformation or turning around urban public schools that he called failures. All of those things had absolutely no research basis underpinning them, and predictably their result was the decimation of neighborhood public schools in all of our major cities in the United States, and that has impacted African American and Latino communities especially adversely. And we have to remember that the education realm has an impact beyond just schooling, so that when you have in a city where I am, like Detroit, where you have 200 schools that have closed in the last, not all of those under Arne Duncan's watch, but certainly 100 of them under Arne Duncan's watch, the effects on the community in general are simply devastating, and partake in this larger process of dispossessing the African-American communities largely in Detroit from the neighborhoods they've inhabited for decades, and making space for either gentrification or for the installment of what they call blue space, blue water features, or green space, which I think we're probably more familiar with. So Arne Duncan's legacy is one of relying on reforms that just seemed to appeal to him. And of course, they didn't just appeal to him. There were a lot of people standing behind him, both in his origins in Renaissance 2010 and other projects of his in Chicago, and extending all the way through his time in the Obama administration. They were all programs that relied on a faith, at least rhetorically, a faith in so-called free markets to be able to deliver efficiency to a public sector that we were to believe was dominated by self-interested public sector workers and administrators, especially teachers and their teachers' unions. Largely, we've seen the projects of Arne Duncan and also his predecessors, and they'll continue with New York Schools Commissioner John King, being one of seeing market solutions, at least rhetorically, as the solution to public sector woes, and largely a war on unions, and of course also a war on low-income urban communities of color who seem to just not be in the right place at the right time right now. But so, I'll stop.
Go ahead. I'm listening.
Okay. So it's important to see that Obama has, in fact, not engaged in the type of change that we hoped would begin to signal a real shift away from this deep belief in neoliberal policies. And I guess that's what I wanted to get at with this notion of rhetorical commitment to educational markets. Because when you start to peel it back, you realize that although for many of us who have been watching the education sector, the public sector in general, we've never believed in market solutions to public sector problems. We believe that the public sector problems are themselves the result of longstanding and increasing disinvestment, particularly in the public sector that serves the most at need in the United States. And of course, this is happening globally as well. But that commitment to markets is largely rhetorical, and its real purpose, besides ideologically to serve Republicans and Democrats who are deeply invested in a neoliberal understanding of the world, is to serve particular profit makers who aren't themselves often interested in markets, right? They're disinterested in market capture. They're not really interested in market competition. They want to capture that space. And so really that's the legacy, the most important legacy of Arne Duncan, I suppose you could say, besides the failed reforms. We would look at the failed reforms and we'd say, well, he's just a dolt, because he proposed four reforms that had no evidence and continued to use them. They produced no positive returns for anyone. They simply undermined democracy. They destroyed cities. They destroyed schools. But they have served someone. They've been very useful and very successful for someone. And maybe that's the point, is that these are a lot of the same people, the hedge fund investors, real estate investors, other financial investors, who have always supported Arne Duncan, and who are the prime supporters of Barack Obama's presidency as well, by the way. And they've been served quite well. We have a massive transfer of wealth from the public sector to private hands. And I think that would be the headline right there, is the movement of public sector wealth, where that concentration of public sector wealth was itself seen as the enemy before, is now no longer the enemy, because it can itself be captured on the end by for-profit and even non-profit where there's still a great amount of profit providers. That's the headline.
This is a major, a really condemnatory picture here. And it is startling all the more that you would expect the National Education Association, the leading or the largest union, having to be the union of teachers, would say something. You would expect leading educators to be concerned about the ascendancy of John King Jr., the legacy of Arne Duncan, the facts and statistics as you have just presented them, that indict a president who came to power largely on the strength of the votes of people who were looking for an entirely different approach to education. The sad and sorry reality that those ideals that they thought the president shared with them, in fact, have been betrayed. One would expect that there would have been a big outcry here and a demand, an urgent demand to meet with the president and to consider, even at this late date, 1 year to go before his own presidency ends, that there would be at least some major attempt to get this thing somehow rectified and put back on the track as best they could. Does it surprise you that it's just business as usual?
Well, I think you were alluding there in part to we last time you and I spoke, you just, I believe we were speaking about the at that time the AFT's endorsement of Hillary Clinton, and now we have the NEA's recent endorsement of Hillary Clinton as well. So you were speaking of outcry, and you'd expect at least at an organizational level to have teachers' unions be the leaders in some of that outcry, along with communities of color. And of course, we always have to remind ourselves that we have seen significant outcry. We've seen the building in the last few years of the Journey for Justice Alliance and other important offshoot groups who have come back to say, now wait a minute, a lot of the traditional civil rights organizations that have at least maintained a tepid endorsement of a lot of our high-stakes testing culture don't represent well the real concerns of African-American communities and Latino communities who have suffered so much at the hands of these educational reforms. But nevertheless, we do have a real crisis in our union movement as well. And it seems that what has really come to pass is a real and growing disjuncture at a couple of different levels, a disjuncture between the leadership of our union movement, if you, I don't know if we could call it a union, our movement, our corporate unions and their business, and communities of color and their interests, which is devastating because these traditionally were two of the main components of a more social democratic alliance or front within the Democratic Party and within U.S. politics in general. So you've seen that disjuncture, but you've also seen a disjuncture at the level of leadership, between leadership and rank and file within unions. And so really, just as we've had to struggle so much within the Democratic Party, largely, unfortunately, in a way, in a losing way, between a growing neoliberal consensus within the Democratic Party and its waning social democratic wing, we see something very similar in that we not only cannot assume that Democrats will be pro-urban communities of color and pro-urban public schools, we can't even assume that about unions anymore either. We have the same internal fight. Now, I don't want to be too negative. It is a sad moment when we see where the Obama administration has gone with the appointment of John King after such a disaster. But nevertheless, we do see struggles. We do see successful struggles. We see in Chicago that a successful alliance between the teachers' union and communities was created and resulted in tremendous political mobilization and a new sense of possibility and a new social imaginary in Chicago. We've also seen some of that potentiality where I'm located, Detroit, and I'll contextualize that really quickly. I know I've spoken about it a little bit before on your show. Detroit has been an important site for Arne Duncan. He came here in 2009 and said he loses sleep over our city. He recognized that Detroit did not suffer The benefits of a hurricane like he saw in New Orleans, with the complete reshaping of the educational landscape in New Orleans, and wished for dramatic change in Detroit as well, called it Ground Zero for education reform. And what we've seen instead is a process of the complete displacement of local democratic community control of schools and the imposition of state control that has simply devastated the city and devastated the schools, resulting in, as I've mentioned before, the massive flight of students from the district. It's a huge financial calamity. We're now under emergency financial managers with all of their skills taken from the corporate sector, and the efficiency we're supposed to believe that is hatched there has brought the Detroit Public Schools to a point where the deficit has exploded now to almost $500 million, the annual operating deficit. And what's the solution to an emergency financial management-induced calamity? Well, more emergency management under state imposition. But I was trying to sound hopeful, and there I go again, right? But it's the reality of the moment that we're in. What I do want to point to is a few recent successes. I love to point out that when you look at an important dynamic within education, which is this whole corporate philanthropy movement with the Broads and the Waltons and the Gates and many others, but those are the big three, moving forward this totally, utterly disproven educational so-called reform narrative, that they have been the major pushers of this over the last 10 years or so. They've been very active in Detroit, too. The Broad Foundation has been the primary sponsor. Really, it's the Educational Achievement Authority in Detroit is the brainchild of Eli Broad and his pet project. And really quickly to sort of patch back, when we talk about Eli Broad, we have to recognize the connections that do exist between both the AFT and the NEA and Eli Broad, that there unfortunately are many more alliances, at least at the top, between those factions of the educational landscape than we would expect. But anyway, so in Detroit, we had just two summers ago, $67 million poured into the already failed Education Achievement Authority, which has been headed by two Broad superintendency graduates since its inception, and has been a calamity in the even in the realm of the one metric that neoliberal reformers seem to be wed to, which is the state-mandated test scores. The results have been calamitous. Believers in education markets think that it's the customer that will dictate the path forward. Well, the EAA has lost more than a third of its customers within its first 2 years, yet you have the irony of Republicans and neoliberal Democrats who insist on propping up the EAA nonetheless, despite its market failure. So you have a state-sponsored market failure. It's hard to wrap your head around that sort of vision of why Republicans and Democrats would advocate such a thing. I think we do have explanations when it comes to those who are curried with favors who do propose these sort of inventions. In any case, $67 million was poured into the Education Achievement Authority. And because of the work of a number of grassroots community activists and the coalitions they were able to form across the state, and the work of intrepid researchers, including someone who I believe might be your guest later this hour, Kurt Guyette, in exposing the Education Achievement Authority, we've really been able to show the Education Achievement Authority to be the scandalous failure that it is, and have turned its name toxic. So $67 million versus some small-time, largely already disrespected in the regular media, activists and some facts, and we've been able to hold it at bay, at least so far. And one thing that we're learning, too, is how to stop this endless cycling of loser leaders who certainly don't represent the communities that they've been installed to supposedly represent. People like Arne Duncan, who progressed from Chicago into the White House, or Rod Paige before him and the supposed Houston miracle, which has been totally debunked, who was the originator of No Child Left Behind under the Bush administration. We have someone who was the first chancellor, again, a Broad graduate, John Covington, over the EAA, who left here in disgrace after numerous scandals, including that he had been using public monies to be chauffeured around town and to had a large expense account. He was a candidate for the Nashville superintendent's position. They have a different name for the individual, but it's essentially a superintendent. He was one of four finalists, and he was apparently a very promising finalist in their eyes. But what we were able to do, again, without that $67 million that we're fighting against, is we were able simply to communicate our research and our experiences with John Covington over the EAA to the folks who actually are activists in the Nashville context and also directly to the board members of the Nashville Public Schools. They received our research. As soon as they received it and other very important information, John Covington was jettisoned as a candidate. Given the damage he did, hopefully he'll never work with children again. We hope to make that the beginning of a pattern where if you hurt our children in one city, we'll try to get you out. And when you leave, you're not going to be able to pick up. And, you know, even though Broad Foundation will try to give you a soft landing so you can do your deed somewhere else, we're going to make that as impossible as we can for you to do. And I never felt more proud than when I was at a recent gathering in New Orleans of education activists from 10 major cities across the country, and I happened to be sitting next to, it turned out, one of the Nashville board members, and she and I spoke and realized how we'd been connected in this effort to keep John Covington away from their schools. And it was just a great moment to be able to share with all the conference attendees how we'd been able to do that, just with our few facts and a little bit of citizen power. And
in the meantime, we have to recognize that this president has been lethal. His administration has been lethal to education, and it was not by accident. And in the turnover that we are currently witnessing with Arne Duncan leaving and Mr. King coming in, behind him the undersecretary being the clone of Arne Duncan, we see that we can only interpret this to be that the president is dedicated to the corporatization, the commodification, the market-driven policy toward education. This is not accidental at all. Thank you so much, Tom, for joining us today. And we will pursue this in greater detail in the near future. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. Have a nice day.
Thank you. We go from Detroit a little bit north, where the cash-strapped city of Flint, Michigan, currently under state-imposed emergency management, is distributing free water filters to residents after it was discovered that children had inordinately high levels of lead in their system. Well, how did it get there? You see, since last year, the city has been using water from the Flint River in order to cut its costs. Our guest, Kurt Guyatt, is an investigative reporter for the ACLU of Michigan. He broke the story. He says local authorities consistently denied that a public danger existed, and now residents are in a pitched battle to safeguard their and their children's health. Thanks, Kurt, for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me on. And it's a real honor to follow Tom Pedroni.
Yes, he's been incredibly resourceful in helping us understand education in a very different way. And perhaps you can help us understand this current crisis being experienced in Flint, Michigan.
Yes, happy to. It ties in directly, interestingly enough, with the previous subject, the EAA schools in Detroit, because both crises have resulted, a direct result of Michigan's emergency management law. And it is the most extreme law of its type in the country. All states have some sort of receivership laws regarding financially troubled school districts, cities, counties. But no place does an appointed emergency manager have the extreme authority that are given those people in Michigan. They're appointed by the governor. They have complete authority over whatever jurisdiction they're put in place. They can break existing ordinances. They can create new ordinances. They can deny health care benefits to retirees. The only thing that the law says they can't do is miss a bond payment, which I think is very telling about the real purpose of the law. So Flint had a whole series of these emergency managers, and in April of 2014, as a cost-cutting measure imposed by one of these appointed emergency managers, Flint left the Detroit water system, which has a very high quality of water, and started drawing its water from the Flint River. And there has been a whole series of health problems occurring ever since then. Excuse me. And the current situation involves high levels of lead. And the high levels of lead are a result of the fact that the Flint River is five times more corrosive than the Detroit water that the city had been using for 50 years. And so because of that high corrosivity, lead from old lead pipes, the part of the city's infrastructure, has been leaching into the water. And that is now been confirmed two different ways. One was a study that was really the initiative of local Flint residents who refused to believe city and state officials when told that their water was safe to drink. The ACLU of Michigan and researchers at Virginia Tech University, those three groups worked together to conduct our own tests of Flint water in August. Over a little more than a two-week period, 300 test kits were distributed to homes throughout the city. 277 were collected, which is, excuse me again, I'm sorry, really significant. The city, over a course of 6 months, got 69 houses tested. We did four times as many of that in a little over 2 weeks. Even more significant is the result of our test showed that the city was really not in compliance with federal regulations governing lead in water systems. The city and state claimed that their tests showed that the water was in conformity with federal regulations and safe. Our test, to the contrary, showed that the water was not safe, that the far exceeded the federal limits on lead, and was in direct contradiction to what the city found and state. As they had done all along, because this goes back to July when we revealed the existence of an internal EPA memo which laid out the scientific basis for explaining why lead was a problem in Flint's system based on a few tests that were done independently. So jump ahead. Our results were released on September 15th. Soon after that, doctors at Hurley Children's Hospital in Flint, building on the Virginia Tech study, did an analysis of lead levels in the blood of children 5 years and under. To do this analysis, they looked at a nine-month period before the switchover, and then 9 months after the switchover. And what they found was that after the switchover, the number of kids with elevated levels of lead in their blood doubled. And in the areas of the city where the Virginia Tech test found the highest levels of lead in the water, the Hurley study found the highest levels of lead in the blood of children. So there was a correlation between what the Virginia Tech tests found and what the Hurley test found. So it helped both validate the Virginia Tech test and build on it. Again, amazingly enough, the initial reaction on the part of the state was to try to discredit the Hurley test. Just as they tried to discredit the Virginia Tech test, they tried to discredit the Hurley test, to the point where they turned over state data to the one of the daily newspapers here, the Detroit Free Press. The Detroit Free Press data analysis person looked at the state's number and said, well, geez, actually, you guys are wrong. Your numbers confirm what the doctors at Hurley found. It doesn't disprove it. It confirms it. So finally, the evidence was so overwhelming and the public reaction so intense that the county health department issued a health warning about the levels of lead, and the state and city were finally forced to concede that the water was not safe to drink, contrary to what they had been saying since last April of 14. But rather than return to the Detroit system, which Mark Edwards, the lead scientist at Virginia Tech, says, and community activists are calling for, increasing number of state legislators are calling for, the doctors at Hurley called for, the ACLU of Michigan, Natural Resources Defense Council have called for in a petition that we just filed with the EPA, and citizens groups all calling for a return to Detroit, and so far the state and city are balking at that. They say they don't need to. They're going to start putting corrosion control chemicals, which should have been included in the water all along. They're now going to start adding that, and they're distributing water filters to people in the city. That's their plan for dealing with this crisis.
In the meantime, you have an entire city, Flint, Michigan, an entire city that is being poisoned by its water. And the solution, according to the officials, the best solution is to hand out water filters.
Yes, it's sort of as ludicrous as that sounds. That's exactly the case. That's exactly the case. But at least people can take heart in the fact that at least the truth is now being told, and people are aware. And the right water filters can be a big help. But up until really just a couple weeks ago, people were still being told that the water was safe. And so what happened with the Virginia Tech study was really a remarkable thing. And I don't think that there's ever been anything else quite like it. I really, as far as I know, I think it was precedent-setting in that they had citizens groups. There's a whole coalition of groups there fighting for clean water. The Virginia Tech researchers and then the ACLU of Michigan all teaming up in the way that we did, and we all brought certain things to the effort. You know, part of what my role was as an investigative reporter, I started digging into things that the city did in order to skew its tests, in order to have the end result be that the levels of lead were diminished. And that was needed because when the Virginia Tech study was released, the natural question was, well, how comes your results are so different than the city's results? And so I was able to be there and give a good documented reason why that was the case. The citizens did an extraordinary thing. Mark Edwards at Virginia Tech applied to the National Science Foundation for an emergency grant to study the situation. When he applied for that grant, he said that we'll distribute 300 kits, and based on some things that have happened in the past, we're going to budget for 75 kits to get collected in return for analysis. you know, instead of 75, there were 277, which is just a testament to the unbelievable effort on the parts of these grassroots groups, just getting out there and working first to get the test distributed. And we did it in such a way. We had a meeting after 200 tests were distributed. We sat down and looked at zip codes and to see where all the kids that had been distributed landed. And then we said, okay, well, these are parts of the city that we're light on. And so we went out there knocking on doors, asking people to agree to have their water sampled in order that we had as good a distribution throughout the city as possible, unlike the way the city did its test, which were big clusters of homes in certain neighborhoods. And in one case, a neighborhood where it was pretty much guaranteed the results are going to come in low because a water main had just been put in within the past decade, and that new water main would not be as corroded as the old mains, and the corrosion in the water mains helps contribute to the leaching of lead in the lead service lines that lead to houses. So
I have to ask you here, Kurt. Flint, Michigan is one of several mostly African-American cities in the state of Michigan currently under emergency management. And as you mentioned at the beginning of your talk, emergency managers basically have incredible amounts of power, mm-hmm. and a lot of leeway to basically disregard all the democratic processes that would normally apply, where people vote on things and review things and so forth.
Well,
is there a correlation in your view that this casual attitude on the part of government, which, by the way, if this were done knowingly by any other group, the word terrorism would have come up because it is tantamount to knowingly poisoning an entire city, especially its children. Knowingly, everybody knows the effects of lead. Everybody knows how lethal lead can be. And when a city knowingly allows its entire population to be exposed to this kind of toxicity, you're with the ACLU. Is the ACLU taking any action in light of a claim, I suppose, for lack of a better word, that this was, in fact, a deliberate effort on the part of the city to allow the toxic poisoning of an entire city?
One thing to point out, Flint is not currently under the control of an emergency manager. The emergency manager left in April, but it is still technically under receivership because there's something called a transition advisory board that is in place as in compliance with the state's emergency manager law. And the transition advisory board has the authority to approve or reject budget proposals as well as major contracts. And so if it's still not up to the elected officials in Flint whether to stay on the river or go back to Detroit, that is a decision that would have to be approved by the Transition Advisory Board. In addition, on his way out the door, the emergency manager said, by the way, no order I issued or my predecessors issued can be overturned until at least a year after the city is out of receivership. And so they basically locked all their orders into place while the city is in receivership. And as long as there's a transition advisory board, it's still in receivership. But to your point, the whole crisis is directly related to decisions by emergency managers in several ways. Originally, the city council voted and the mayor approved of the going to the river. But at that point, they were completely beholden to the goodwill of the emergency manager. The emergency manager decided how much power the elected officials would have. The emergency manager decided how much pay those people would have. And so they were not acting as an independent body. They were acting as essentially employees. And everybody knows human nature. How many people have the guts to stand up and tell their boss that they think the boss is wrong? Almost nobody. I mean, I've been in hundreds and hundreds of meetings. I hardly ever see anybody tell the boss on something big that they think the boss is wrong. They go along to get along because they want to keep drawing their salary. And we've seen in Michigan what happens when people, boards and city councils don't go along. They get completely disemboweled in terms of having any kind of power. We've seen it with the elected Detroit School Board. We saw it with the city council out in Benton Harbor, which is another town that was under emergency management. There, the city emergency manager said, yeah, the law says I have to allow you to meet, but here's what you're going to be able to do. You're going to be able to call a meeting to order. You're going to be able to approve the minutes from the previous meeting, and you're going to be able to call the meeting to a close, and that's it. And that's what happens when city councils don't play ball with the emergency manager, when they try to fight them. They just get gutted. And so that's one thing. So when they say in Flint, well, the city council and the mayor agreed with this, you know, it's a sham argument. The other thing that has become apparent and has really come into focus as a really fatal, I think, flaw in the emergency manager law is this. Under normal circumstances, in a typically functional democracy, you would have the city of Flint as an independent actor going out and collecting water samples according to rules prescribed by the federal government. And the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality, as a separate independent actor, would have as its role overseeing the city and making sure that this monitoring was done correctly. In this case, you have an appointed emergency manager put in place by the governor, make this horribly flawed damaging decision to switch to the river for no other reason but to save money. And when the results of that begin to make themselves manifest, instead of having the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality there as a watchdog, they, which are part of the administration, right? It's the MDEQ is run by a gubernatorial appointee, just as the city was. They're there not to make sure everything is done correctly. Their role becomes to not do anything that's going to embarrass the governor. And because it was the result of the governor's emergency manager that created the situation, instead of blowing the whistle on the problem, they were right there, shoulder to shoulder, with the emergency manager saying, nothing to see here, folks, keep moving. The water's safe, the water's safe, the water's safe. And they had to be, if it weren't for the actions of independent actors, most importantly, the citizens of Flint themselves who refused to accept those lies, you know, kids would still be getting lead poisoned. The city and state would still be saying, look, our tests show there's not a problem with lead in our water. And it would absolutely be going on. And so you cannot credit those citizen actions and the great work at Virginia Tech enough, and giving a model for what others can do to show that they don't have to accept what their government is feeding them. That if they have the energy and the wits and the willpower, they can force change. And I think this is a beautiful example of that.
And credit goes to you too, Kurt, for bringing this story to light and for allowing people to understand the enormity of a crisis that is being responded to by the local government distributing a couple of hundred water filters and saying, here, this ought to fix it, and life goes on. Thanks so much for joining us today. We'll be following up this story, but I want to thank you so much for the work you've done with regard to this and other issues as well. Thank you.
Thank you for having me on. It was a pleasure.
Thanks so much. Well, how do you punish a city when you really mean to punish a city, why do you get Wall Street to do it? And that's exactly what's happening in Ferguson, Missouri. Very quietly last month, Moody's Investors Service decided that it was going to cut the credit rating of Ferguson to junk status. That means that the city of Ferguson, for all intents and purposes, is no place that anybody would want to invest or back municipal bonds to build anything. It is the beginning of the disemboweling of a city. That's how they do it. You see, by then, when Moody's made this decision, this was in mid-September, actually, as I found out, the decision had been in. The Justice Department had excoriated Missouri for blatant racism and targeting blacks and using the local black population there literally as a source of revenue, which is what explains why Ferguson and the people of Ferguson were bearing an inordinate burden, an inordinate tax burden, although it didn't look like taxes. But they were being ticketed more than anybody else. They were being thrown in jail and bail demanded more than anybody else. They were fined for the smallest infractions. Your grass is too long. You parked your car in the wrong place. All these things generated money for the city of Ferguson. Now, African Americans in Ferguson did not get nearly the return on that kind of investment, but in any event, the investment was at their expense and it was brutal. And it was authenticated. That's what the Justice Department said. We had, as I reported on this program, a decision by a judge. In fact, he took a look at what needed to be done and said, well, we will disregard all these warrants up until December of last year, and we will start afresh. Because that was a signal that the judge also understood that the people of Ferguson were being targeted, specifically on the basis of their race. And they were, in fact, a source of revenue. Well, what do you know? Once that happened, you had official condemnation. First, you had official recognition that there was a problem, and it was absolutely race-based. There was no question about that. And then came the demands for, quote, reform. And the reforms were the suspension of these warrants, meaning people were given basically a shot at starting over without the threat of the city garnishing their wages and putting them in jail for their inability to pay for these ridiculous fines that were levied against them. And you had the condemnation of the police and the law enforcement authorities saying that essentially the situation in Ferguson, Missouri was blown out of proportion. Well, Wall Street stepped in and did what others couldn't and were not able to do. And it systematically decided that it will bring Ferguson to its knees. It was kind of on its way there, but this was really, really important. So it decided to rate the city of Ferguson as to drop its credit rating 7 notches down to junk status. Now, that means that Ferguson, Missouri has not even a prayer in the world of municipal bonds to build anything, to ask for, to get any investors interested in anything, to attract investment of any type, because Moody's essentially is saying, you're not going to get your money back. There is no future in Ferguson, Missouri. And that's how you force a city. This is exactly what happened in Detroit. You force a city into bankruptcy. And a decision somewhere is made. I don't know whether people called a meeting, but and whether it was secret or not. But this is the science of oppression. Ferguson, Missouri, the wrong people won. The wrong people won the battle. And we're going to fix this. And the way we fix this is we eviscerate the town. It was poor to begin with, mostly working class and working poor people and poor people. But now Moody's has stepped in to provide a service that practically no other entity could provide, which is to officially eviscerate the city of Ferguson, Missouri. We'll be talking about this in greater detail next week. And we will have an explanation as to how this is done. But I wanted to bring to your attention that although the focus has been on police brutality and the fight back against it, and all of the shenanigans that you know, we've covered this on this program, this is where the decision has been made to compel an absolute downturn. I mean, drive it, pile drive it into the ground. And that is to remove any possibility that Ferguson, Missouri has a shot at bouncing back. Now, the odd thing, as we will discover next week, is that Ferguson, Missouri, in fact, does have a tax base. Ferguson, Missouri should not even be wanting for taxes. Ferguson, Missouri should not be in debt of any type based on the business base that is there. But it is big business, big corporate business, doing, in one case, $6 billion a year worth of business. But it is the poor people of Ferguson who have been carrying the load. It is the poor persons of Ferguson who have been targeted by the police, targeted by the municipality, targeted by the state. They are the ones who, through the systematic violation of their constitutional rights, they are the ones bearing the burden of tax, the tax burden of Ferguson, Missouri. But this move by Moody's is really, really significant because the city of Ferguson has some debt. All municipalities have debt. And it's really not that significant. But what the formula seems to be is that whatever debt it has, imprisonment of the local people will pay it. Ticketing of the local people will pay it. Fines will pay it. Garnishing salaries will pay it. And we give the big business people a break. And now that Moody's has declared their credit rating to be junk status, it now sets the tone, it now sets the atmosphere in which a bunch of other decisions will be made to systematically empty the city, just like Detroit. We just finished talking about Flint, Michigan. And I've been telling you, these are things you need to study in the way of systems theory because they're all connected. They follow the same pattern. You have an entire city, we just talked about, an entire city exposed to huge toxicity, and it's been documented. And still, the attitude is, well, you know, we give them a couple of filters, and that ought to solve it. But we continue to poison the city. You say this to people, they say, you're making this up. I'm not making it up. This is official policy. This is official attitude. And the only thing that allows people to think that way is that they can get away with it, and the targeted population is deemed as expendable. Further, they have little or no political protection. So I thought I'd bring this to your attention. We'll be following this up next week. The systematic disemboweling of a city. And largely it was because the wrong people won a fight. And a whole system, they may have worked independently, they may have worked in accordance with each other, I don't know. But we can see how methodically and scientifically and strategically they meticulously set about and target a city for annihilation. And this is how it's done. Thanks so much for joining me today. I hope we learned something. I certainly did from our guests about education, about the willful poisoning of a majority black city, Flint, Michigan, and about a city that's being set up now to absolutely fail. Stay tuned. Coming up next is the NDC Savings Club. You can reach me at leadstories@gmail.com. Let me know what you think about these programs. Until then, please know from me, it is a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your esteemed company. We'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.